Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marino Onwokolo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. If you're new here, welcome. It's nice to have you here. If you're a regular, hey, how's it going? So this is the podcast where I share a lot of the super interesting conversations I have with really cool people. I'm a firm believer in sharing ideas that shape and challenge the world as we know it. My hope is that these conversations, where you get to be a fly on the wall, start further and deeper conversations wherever you are and lead to the exploring of actions and ideas that actually work and make a difference. So without further ado, let's get straight into it. Again, I'm Marie Noel and you're listening to the Brentas Foundation podcast. Okay, fly on the wall. Today we will be continuing our Better Choices series. And I will be speaking with Garrett Newham, who wrote the chapter Crime and the Justice System. Garrett has done many things, really, you should look him up. Today, though, he is the head of Justice and Violence Prevention at the Institute for Security Studies, ISS. And I'm so excited to have him here. Why? Well, because he will be helping us understand how crime and the justice system really declined in South Africa and what that means for fixing it, i.e. those priority choices that ought to be considered. Without further ado, let's get straight into the chat. Garrett, welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And how are you keeping?
I am doing very well, thank you. So let's get straight into why we're here, which is to talk about your chapter on crime and justice in the book, Better Choices for South Africa. So at the beginning of your chapter, you write that South Africa has persistently failed to adequately build the rule of law since the birth of democracy in 1994. I think that's a great line, and we can start from there. Can you share a little bit about the measure of this failure and what the practical implications have become or have been over the years?
Well, the reason why I make that argument is I think that there has been too much political interference in the operation of the criminal justice agencies, which are there to try and ensure that we uphold the constitutional principle of the rule of law, where everybody is treated equally. We saw quite early on within the governing party, the African National Congress, that there was a tendency to protect those that were seen on the inside, despite evidence of wrongdoing. And that meant having to control the criminal justice system. This was very pronounced during Thabo Mbeki's time, when his then National Director of Public Prosecutions decided not to prosecute former then Deputy President Jacob Zuma, despite a mountain of hard evidence that he was involved in corruption, seemingly for no good reason. And that was later proven true, because Jacob Zuma is now facing prosecution on exactly that same evidence, and that evidence was used to convict Jacob Zuma's former financial advisor, Shabir Sheikh, on corruption. So there we saw how, for political reasons, there was an interference or a lack of willingness to just act on the evidence of criminality and make sure that a person, no matter who they were, was held accountable. We saw that even earlier with Thabo Mbeki trying to protect Jackie Selebi by interfering with then National Prosecuting Authority head Wusi Pikoli, because Wusi Pikoli wanted to arrest Jackie Selebi and Thabo Mbeki didn't want him to. So then, this is going back into the sort of early 2000s, mid-2000s, you really see very clear examples of interference in the operation of our criminal justice system to protect people despite hard evidence of serious corruption and wrongdoing. The consequence has been that this precedent has grown, and we have seen huge interference across all agencies that are meant to support public safety and the rule of law, leading to massive deterioration in these systems, particularly during the state capture period, so that we now have a very difficult situation with massive growing organized crime. Our murder rate has gone up by 38% in the last decade. And massive collapse of the system is meant to try and provide safety for all. So that was the consequence of those decisions back then by politicians who should have known better.
So that definitely gives us something to work on. And even, you know, mentioning Thabo Mbeki, I think it goes back quite a bit, or a lot more than sometimes we hear, at least on the outside. And I think you wrote that, you know, many people tend to put this period that became known as sort of state capture, right, from 2012 to about 2015, thereabouts. But it started earlier than that. And also there was, in terms of its beginning, it was targeted at like the intelligence and law enforcement agencies. Can you share a little bit about that and why that was important? I'm not sure if you've done some work into the reason of why.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of people really, when they look at state capture, when the most serious abuses were taking place, identify 2011-12 as when you started to see real efforts to kind of go after the big state-owned enterprises such as Transnet and Eskom and that, to try and repurpose them so that huge amounts of their budgets could be extracted for personal gain, corruption. But what we saw was that very shortly after Jacob Zuma became president in April of 2009, 2 months afterwards, he became president, and he had two posts that he needed to fill in the South African Police Service. One was the National Commissioner post, and the other one was the Head of Crime Intelligence. Both were vacant, and there were people in acting positions in those posts, but they were just waiting for the president to make a decision on who to put there. And Jacob Zuma decided to, two months after he was appointed, as president, he appointed a man called Richard Mdluli, who was then the head of crime intelligence in Gauteng, as the national head of crime intelligence. Richard Mdluli at the time was facing unresolved charges or allegations of murder, kidnapping, assault, defeating the ends of justice. And he had been quite instrumental, allegedly, in enabling the president to make the case that he shouldn't be prosecuted for corruption, because there was a taped conversation between the then head of the Scorpions investigation unit, Mr. McCarthy, and the former national head of prosecutions, Bulelani Ngqika. And in there, they were discussing whether it would be better or not to charge Jacob Zuma for corruption before or after the then African National Congress in Polokwane, the national conference. So that little bit of tape came out, and it was used to try and prove that there were interference in that investigation into Jacob Zuma. And on that basis, the charges were dropped. However, it later turned out that they actually had no impact on the charges, because the decision to institute the charges lay elsewhere and were not influenced whatsoever by that discussion between two private individuals. However, initially thought that it was an attempt to reward Richard Mdluli because of his interference and his willingness to share top secret classified information with a civilian against the law, that Jacob Zuma then appointed him as he had demonstrated his loyalty to Jacob Zuma, and he had helped Jacob Zuma, so it was a recognition award for that. Yeah. However, we later saw how Richard Mdluli started to operate when he was in that position. He started to take over the crime intelligence division by appointments. So he appointed around 220 people into key positions across the crime intelligence division. There are about 4,000 people in that sort of division in the police across the country. But these 200 were family members and friends, mostly without necessary qualifications or training or skills, expertise and intelligence, but largely to get them into the position so he could control what was going on and then use that crime intelligence capability for political reasons. So he knew that was happening, but it became later more apparent why that was happening. 2 months after Richard Mdluli was appointed, then Bheki Cele was appointed as National Commissioner of Police. At that time, Bheki Cele was a loyalist to Zuma, and we know that Zuma would often phone Bheki Cele with very specific instructions about which investigations should be stopped, typically those influencing his family members or targeting his family members or their associates, and who should be under investigations. So direct interference like that. It then became much clearer that that was actually the forerunner for state capture. So once Jacob Zuma could put his loyalists, because that was just, I gave you two examples in the police, but he did the same things with the National Prosecuting Authority, he did the same things with intelligence agencies. He put people that he believed he could control or were deeply loyal to him personally or politically in key positions so that he could manipulate what got investigated and what got shut down. So we saw initial investigations into the Guptas being shut down in 2011. We've did quite a substantial submission to the Zondo Commission pointing out how this all happened. And for example, Menzi Semolani had been the Director General of Justice doing a portfolio, a parliamentary inquiry. It was found that he not only withheld crucial evidence, there were questions about his honesty and his integrity, and there were questions about his competence, his knowledge of the law and the role that the National Prosecuting Authority should play. And his conduct in that inquiry, although he wasn't the subject of the inquiry, he was just a witness, but his conduct was so bad that the inquiry formally recommended to the Public Service Commission that there be an investigation into his conduct and a recommendation as to what should happen to him. That investigation found that he indeed there were serious challenges about his integrity, serious questions about his competence, and that he should not hold any senior position in government, as I understood was the recommendation from the Public Service Commission. It was after that report that Jacob Zuma decided to point Menzi Semolani to the top of the National Prosecuting Authority as the National Director of Public Prosecutions, an immensely powerful and important post. So, you know, Jacob Zuma really wanted to know that you were dishonest or incompetent and that he could control you. And that's once he had that idea, then he would appoint you. He made sure that no honest or competent people were appointed to key positions in the criminal justice system where he could influence those appointments. And that was a pattern that happened regularly every year while he was president. So it was to weaken that system, and we now clearly understand why.
Gareth, I have a question listening to this, right? Was there at any point within this period where anyone could have stopped this? I'm thinking about, you know, the strength of other institutions. Or was it such that they were all sort of co-opted at the same time, that there was nothing that could really be done? Or did we just miss the mark somewhere?
There's no one person who could have stopped it. The only organization that could have stopped it was the African National Congress itself. So if it had decided through its National Executive Committee to strongly stand up to this abuse and to try and ensure that it used its parliamentary powers and responsibilities to really highlight these challenges, because during this time, well, we were one of the organizations providing the evidence to the Portfolio Committee on Police, Portfolio Committee on Justice. So it wasn't secret. It was very well documented. Of course, the shutting down of the Scorpions was another moment that was a huge red flag. The ANC didn't do that. They were mostly behind Zuma and did not care what he did. They just basically fell in line. Those individuals in the government that try to stand up to him, we saw people at the top of intelligence agencies who were very worried about the Guptas, who were trying to buy a uranium mine. Because they had sort of insights that they could possibly start getting a deal with the Russians to build nuclear power stations in South Africa, and they could make an absolute fortune selling uranium. And so that was the first flag in the intelligence sort of community got aware of that. And the top three intelligence heads all warned the Minister of Intelligence about this, and all three of them were forced out or resigned. We saw top police officers trying to push back against instructions to stop investigations into corruption, finding themselves being arrested in front of their families, held in police cells, being their phones being bugged, interfered with. So lots of people did try, but generally found themselves in very difficult situations. And there were a number of alleged assassinations of people further down the food chain, typically at local and some provincial levels, with people that stood up to rampant corruption, and people close to the president were allegedly involved in their deaths. So it was a very dangerous time. It was a time very little could be done. It was just a very sad moment in South Africa's history.
Thank you for outlining that for us. And before I go on to sort of the recommendations, so we talk about how the, you know, criminal justice system basically declined over the years, although 2010 saw a different record, I think largely because of the World Cup you mentioned. But What are some of the main reasons for especially the increased, you know, levels of violence in South Africa? From your research, are there particular themes that have sort of emerged that's driving this, at least when we think about, you know, like the murder rates, for instance?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And there is actually no definitive answer because there are so many factors that drive violence and murder across South Africa, and they differ from place to place. But certainly we saw a huge reduction in murder. Now, why we look at murder and focus on murder is because it's the most accurate or at least unreliable crime statistic that we have. There's quite a close correlation between what the police record and what the National Injury and Mortality Monitoring System, run by the Department of Health, records. So you can see common, you know, there's not much of a difference there. Most bodies are picked up and recorded by the police. Between 1994, 95, when we became a democracy, and 2012, an 18-year period, we saw a massive decline, about 54% drop in the murder rate. It dropped from about 69 murders per 100,000, or sorry, 67 murders per 100,000 in 1994, down to 30 murders per 100,000 in 2012, more or less. Those are the kind of murder rates. And that was probably as a result of various factors. We saw the peace dividend, you know, the political conflict and that was taking place in the dying days of apartheid ended. People bought into the democracy. The government started expanding services. In 1994, there were only 4 million people receiving some kind of social grants. By 2012, this number was up to 17 million people. 3 out of 5 people living in houses were built by the state. There's more electricity, more access to education. So all those expansion of services that the ANC government bought to people in an effort to transform society from apartheid, probably in various ways, played a role. We do know there was one study that showed definitely there was a strong link between the implementation of the firearms legislation, the new Firearms Control Act in 2000, where people's firearm ownership was restricted. You had to obviously go and be tested to make sure that you were competent to use a firearm and understand the regulations and the laws around owning and using firearms. And so hundreds of thousands of firearms were taken out of circulation at the hands of civilians. And the numbers of people shot dead across all categories, pretty much, and we're talking about men, women, and children, dropped by more than half between 2000, with the introduction of this legislation, and 2010. Whereas the other causes of death, murder, such as blunt force trauma, stabbings, and so forth, remained relatively consistent. So there was definitely a huge yield, a positive benefit to South Africa by removing firearms out of the hands of civilians. And so that was one. That's one study that proves, without a doubt, that contributed to this. But not only that. There were many other factors, as I mentioned. But then, you know, we have the World Cup, so there's a very positive boon in the country, a good energy. Then Jacob Zuma's administration was not interested in solving public problems, improving education, you know, whatever it was. The ministers and people who were deployed to government were simply not really up to the task. That was not their key purpose. They did not have the capabilities or the desire to do that, although pretended they were. There were lots of great plans and policies being made at that time in the state, but very little implementation of anything. And then we started to see the sort of overall deterioration of the state and the economy with growing corruption. And so as the services, and I mean, it didn't just start there. I think we started to see early on, it was around 2006 already, that, you know, people might have got services, that the services were either inconsistent or the quality had declined. So you might be getting electricity, but it's not always there. Or you might be getting water, but it's not always potable. Your kids are going to school, but they're not able to read for their age, so forth. And we started to see growing restlessness. So from about 2006, 2007, we started to see the first signs of increase in public protests against the state. And this has been going up pretty much every year, mostly just since then. But those early sort of challenges in governance became far greater under the Zuma administration because of what I mentioned, the people that were not concerned with fixing those problems. And so the The extent to which state capability to provide services and improve people's lives started to deteriorate across all sectors, particularly at local government level. And so we started to see a growing rate of public dissatisfaction. By 2012, I think this is well established. And we then start seeing, in the police at least, the first signs of real institutional and structural deterioration. And so for the next 10 years, the ability of the police to solve murders, for example, between 2012 and 2021 dropped by 51%. Ability to solve armed robberies dropped by 30%. Ability to solve all violent crime by almost a quarter. And then huge declines in, for example, air support operations dropped by 89%. The ability to hold disciplinary hearings against police officers who had allegedly committed misconduct of some kind dropped by 71%. And the ability to reduce firearms, remove firearms out of the streets, out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them, dropped by over 50%. So, and this was a period when the police budget increased by 66%. So despite this massive increase in the police budget, you see virtually every aspect of police capability declining under Zuma. Yeah. And that's just the police. I mean, that happened in the NPA, it happened in intelligence, it happened in education, it happened everywhere. And so I think as the state became less reliable and was people started to lose trust in the state, we started to see surveys coming out with people saying they don't trust the state, they don't trust the president, they don't trust politicians. This opened up the space for local criminal networks and groups to assert themselves. So the growth of gangs, illegal mining, taxi violence, all those kinds of vigilantism, all indicators of where the state is mistreated and other actors step in to provide kind of social control. But they generally, and they're willing to use violence to do this, and they're not guided by our constitutional principles or overall public safety. They might be partly driven or partly responsive to communities. So gangs, taxi associations and so forth, and business forums provide communities that support them or in the communities in which they operate, they'll provide them with loans, with food, with electricity, money for electricity, you know, that kind of thing. So they have strong loyalty, but they're basically competing for the state for control. And as the police sort of is the state's initial law enforcement arm, deteriorated, withdrew and wasn't available, others stepped in, and that led to, where there was conflict, a growing amount of conflict between groups who would then use targeted assassinations or violence to assert their dominance, gain territory, and that has been the big shift we've seen. So the murder rate used to be largely driven by interpersonal violence, mostly young men getting into arguments after drinking alcohol and one killing the other one. Now, 10 years later, it's the main driver for violence is organized criminal groupings and conflict between these groups at local level.
So, Gary, there's a lot that is broken. There's a lot that has been allowed to deteriorate. And I'm certain that things that have been done, you've mentioned, you know, 1 or 10 points of the firearms that was tried some time ago. But in this chapter, you basically outlined three main sort of recommendations or critical actions that you thought would help address the sort of level of violence and the deterioration of rule of law and public safety. Can you walk us through these three points and why you think those would help and how they would do so? And it would also be interesting to hear how reactions to your chapter may have changed any of these, if at all.
Yeah, thank you. You know, there's not only three. There's obviously a lot of stuff that has to happen. But I thought that for this chapter, they're three quite important ones, which would probably make a big difference if we could get them right. The first one is that we need to understand that if we want to reduce violence, murder, and organized crime, and improve public safety in South Africa, it's not something the state can do alone. Even if the state is highly efficient and highly effective, given its resources. It still wouldn't be able it would make a big difference, definitely, there's no doubt about it, and it could start the process, but it's never going to be adequate. And the reason why is because the factors that lead to violence or lead to criminal groups forming and so forth lie outside of the control of the criminal justice system. So the police only get activated once a crime has occurred. You know, so once a young man maybe murders another young man, that's when the police are called. But all the factors that led to that young man murdering another young man, abuse of alcohol, being experienced to neglect or trauma or violence as a young child, seeing violence in the community, not being able to adequately get a job and the frustrations of that, Be humiliated by the police when you are arrested. All those experiences which then contribute and have shown to contribute to violent behavior need to be addressed. And in that way, the state needs to see itself as bringing as many role players from different sectors, as much skill and capability that South Africa has to bear on this problem. It's not just a state problem, but it affects everybody inside and outside of the state. So rather than thinking, well, we are going to do this and we do it alone. So for example, what's called the National Security Estimate, which is developed by National Intelligence, State Security Agency, along with police intelligence and others, which is supposed to guide what the government does, is a top secret document that no one can get access to, unless you have got formal top secret clearance. The problem with that is that a lot of the politicization of intelligence and criminal justice capability and people that are in that system that are there, who are influenced primarily by what's going on in the African National Congress and the factions that they support, not public interest. As we saw what happened during the July violence, that is not just something that came from outside the state. That is something that is, and the state failure is because of, in some cases, deliberate. You can't just rely on the state to do this. And if you have compromised intelligence structures, defining what the national security threat is, and then keeping it secret. We don't know what it is. Is it accurate? Should we worry about certain things? What other capabilities can be brought to bear on this challenge from outside the state? Because no one outside the state knows it. So step one is we've got to have a more inclusive process that results in an annual, what I'd call national security risk assessment. And that means that for example, the National Security Council, which we have, should facilitate that process and make sure that they speak to as many different interested actors or people being affected by violence as they can, provide scope for those inputs, so that they get a good picture of what's happening where and who's being affected and how, and where a new emerging threats are coming from that they might not themselves have picked up. We're thinking a lot here in the cyber domain, but there's a variety of different kinds of things going on in different communities. And then that becomes a public document. It doesn't have to have the absolute detail, nitty-gritty of who's doing what where, to the point, you know, that it can compromise intelligence capabilities. But certainly becomes a public document so that everybody knows what are we facing as a country and which sectors can do what where. Where does the capacity to respond to this lie? And it can also be used to assess the state capability so that they know what they need to change. Okay, we don't have enough sufficient cybersecurity capabilities. We need to start training people. We need to start getting into partnerships, with private sector, where most of this capability exists, for example. But there's a whole range of areas that would allow for a much greater inclusive approach to all of us understanding the threats and how we could all play a role. So that would be number one. And then you'd update that regularly every year. And it just it's in line with our constitution. It's a transparent, inclusive, accountable approach to dealing with a massive complex problem that affects all of us. So that's one thing we could change quite quickly, and would change the way that we could think about the problem and also promote new partnerships that are probably not happening now because people don't know that they both have an interest in addressing a key challenge, for example. Secondly, we have to start professionalizing the South African Police Service. This deterioration hasn't slowed down. It's increased since we first picked it up in 2012. And it's primarily a leadership challenge. The reason why it's a leadership challenge was actually identified by the National Planning Commission back in 2011 and was expressed as a serial crisis of top management in the police, quotes, in the National Development Plan of 2012. It saw that when you have people at the top of the organization, so for example, Jackie Selebi was not a police officer, he was corrupted, they just removed him, he got convicted, but they didn't change anything. They didn't change the way they appointed national commissioners, they didn't change the way they vetted people, they didn't change accountability mechanisms over the police, top management. They just removed Jackie Selebi and then continued in merry way. And there were about six people up until 2017 who were appointed in that position. But for 17 years, we didn't have a trained professional policeman or woman run the South African Police Service. There were people who, in short periods, were there for a year or a year and a half or so who were trained police officers, but they were just there in an acting capacity in the president, till the president appointed somebody who they thought would be personally loyal to him. And those people then made dozens of or hundreds of appointments in the police across all functional areas, in procurement, in administration, in intelligence, in detectives, visible policing, you name it, of people who simply were there primarily in order to support their political objectives and were loyal to those various different national commissions at different times. So in 2017, for example, Khumotso Phahlane, who's currently facing the second criminal trial for corruption, made 80 appointments to key positions in the police. 55 of those appointments were to the top management echelon, and he didn't do any assessments on those appointments to determine whether that individual had the necessary expertise and experience and qualifications to fulfill the functions of the post that they were going to be appointed into. And that means that people aren't able to fulfill the functions of these posts. Some of them get involved in corruption and organized crime. Others are there primarily for political reasons. There are also many excellent men and women who are generals and brigadiers, but they can't trust their colleagues. And so that top structure that's supposed to give strategic direction to the police, where people are supposed to be able to trust each other, have a clear vision of what they're trying to achieve, and then utilize the vast resources. We're talking over 100 billion rand a year, with a personnel count of around 178,000 people. You know, there are only 20,000 murders a year, or 25,000 murders a year pretty much last year. And 180,000 police officers have absolutely no idea how to get on top of those 20,000 murders with a 100 billion rand budget. That is not anything else other than a complete failure of leadership at the highest levels. Now, that's been recognized formally in the National Development Plan. So they say set up a multi-sectoral independent national police board consisting of people who understand how to run large organizations, experts in change management, people who understand the different ways in which you recruit, train, motivate people, how you ensure that you get the best bang for your buck, what should the police actually be doing, what is the latest experience in policing internationally in different kinds of contexts, and how do we bring that to bear in understanding our challenge and responding to it. That needs to be in place so that that they can start the process of rejuvenating that top echelon. So as I said, there's about 30 odd lieutenant generals that make up the board of commissioners. That should be the focus, the key starting point. And there are very good people there, but not all of them are very good at all. Some of them involve in corruption, and then you've got these major generals, about 170 of them. Three in crime intelligence have just been arrested last week for corruption. So start cleaning out that structure. Make sure that it operates effectively, that the men and women have been properly vetted, and that they are there for the public interest. There is actually no other way to start fixing the policing problem, because that dysfunction at the top of the organization, because policing is hierarchical, it filters down. So if you have factions at the top, groups in the National Board of Commissioners, groups of generals who are involved working with criminal syndicates or stealing money from the police budget and so forth, they create pockets of loyalties and networks of influence throughout the entire organization. And we start seeing the whole organization starting to deteriorate and fall apart. And that's what we're experiencing and continue to experience. So until that leadership crisis has been addressed, we're not going to see any improvements in policing. Mm-hmm. That's the second one, not easy to do, but is possible with proper, correct political will and possibly some changes to policing regulations. And then lastly, we need to really have a much more focused approach to addressing violence and murders in South Africa, particularly murders and organized crime. Murders are not randomly distributed across our society. There are pockets where murder is very prevalent and very high, and people who can sometimes grow up in those areas, move to other areas, are likely to be violent and in other areas. So put it this way, 50% of all South Africa's murders are recorded in only 12% of all police precincts. It's about 150 precincts out of the 1,150-odd precincts. And then we've done detailed point data analysis of every murder over about 10 years in places like Khayelitsha and Philippi East and others. And you start seeing very clear hotspots in those precincts. So you don't have to do random patrols everywhere in a precinct. And you can start identifying through doc analysis what's driving the murders. Is it interpersonal violence between people who've been drinking in public taverns or alcohol outlets, bars? Or is it people being hijacked? Because there's a very strong association with high levels of robbery and murders, because people get murdered for their vehicles and in street robberies. and you can see where people are being attacked. And the groups that commit robberies operate in a modus operandi that is quite identifiable and it's repetitive. They do the same thing in the same place over and over again. And then they take the goods they've stolen. If it's street robbery, it's going to be cell phones and cheap jewelry. If it's car hijacking, it's going to be vehicles. If it's house robberies, it's going to be expensive IT equipment, computers, laptops, phones, that kind of thing, jewelry. They go and then they sell them to networks, organized networks that deal in goods stolen in robberies. And the police have been very successful back in between 2009 and 2011 over the World Cup in actually identifying these networks and shutting them down, increasing the arrest rates, making sure they've got dedicated detectives on those people, using proper intelligence-driven policing techniques. And, you know, we saw the conviction rates going up. So, for example, between 2011 and 2009 and 2011, hijacking and carjacking dropped by 32%, house robberies by 20%, and business robberies by 19%. Because of a primarily targeted policing approach. You can't expect non-police structures, community police forums, or private sector businesses to be dealing with armed groups that commit violent crime. Yeah. That's a state function. You need highly trained professionals to do that. So what we've been calling for is, you know, replicate that, which has already been proven to work in South Africa with existing resources, and expand it. So if you see, for example, that in certain places or certain murders in Khayelitsha are as a result of alcohol abuse and conflict between young men, there are different initiatives and interventions that don't require the police to go in there and work with those young men. There's different ways of getting people out of gangs, for example, and that don't generally always involve the state. So you would need to have dedicated stations. Police stations can lead on this. They have all the information. They know where the murders are in terms of the data about the murder. Share that with local partners, and then develop local context-specific murder reduction strategies. That'll take you into the networks involved in organized crime and other kinds of illicit markets. And you'll have a far greater impact than what the police tend to do now, which is these big high-visibility operations that yield very little results. So that is something that we've got the knowledge, we've got the resources, we just need the leadership and the willingness to do it. And we could see big shifts in organized crime and a lot of the murders within about 3 to 5 years, if that approach was adopted now. So in a nutshell, those are the three recommendations that would probably make a big difference if adopted soon.
Amazing. Gary, thank you so much for taking the time to share these with us. I mean, these are rather straightforward. Yes, they require a lot. They're quite complex in terms of doing. Not quite complex, actually. They're tough choices to do in a system, I guess, that isn't exactly straightforward or has deteriorated enough to try to turn around. But it is possible, as she said, with the right political will and leadership. And I hate to say we hope that it's done, but hopefully in the next few years when we're having these conversations, it's better news and it's a more upward trajectory to try to create the state that, you know, South Africa can be, to try to instill some of that confidence back here, not only from investors, but even people in general. Because the narrative around South Africa sometimes outside can be a bit devastating to hear, if I can call it that. I'm not sure if that's your experience. But thank you so much for the time, for doing this with me and for sharing the insights. And hopefully people pick up the book and read the chapter, because there is more in there. You gave us a brief run through, but there's so much more that I hope people do garner when they read the book. So thank you, Garrett.
Thanks so much, Marie Noel. It's been a pleasure.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrentesfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brentes Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.